Well, we've come to that point in the program where I'm going to introduce the Founders Memorial Lecture Award winner, who will then make his presentation. The Founders Memorial Award was established in 1958 to honor the memory of scientists who made outstanding contributions to entomology. This year, Dr. Ken Raffa, a professor in the Department of Entomology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, will honor Dr. Andrew Delmar Hopkins, who is widely recognized as the father of North American forest entomology. Dr. Raffa studies the ecology of tree-feeding insects with special emphasis on complex interactions that influence whether herbivore populations remain stable or erupt to landscape-scale disturbances. These studies have included explorations of host plant relationships, predator-prey interactions, and symbioses. Therefore, it's highly appropriate for him to speak to us tonight about Dr. Andrew Delmar Hopkins, an ESA fellow who headed the USDA Division of Forest Insects for 19 years, who laid the groundwork for its mission, structure, and approaches for decades to come. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Raffa.
Thank you, Dave. The founder I'd like you to join me in honoring tonight is Andrew Delmar Hopkins. He's known as the father of North American forest entomology. And in addition to that, he was an outstanding taxonomist, a pioneer of plant-insect interactions, and a pioneer of bioclimatics, certainly an area that is extremely relevant under today's conditions. I'd like to start out by thanking a couple of people. First of all, Bill Mattson for nominating me. It really is an honor and very humbling to be nominated by somebody you admire so deeply as I admire Bill. And I'd also want to thank the folks who took the time to write letters on my behalf. We live in a time where we're really all very busy, things are quite stressful, and I really appreciate you taking out that time. I also want to thank University of Wisconsin for giving me an opportunity. And also, we have a department there that is incredibly collegial. And in this day of micromanagement, UW is a place where there are no boundaries to interdisciplinary collaboration, and we really have the freedom to do what we want. UW has been referred to as the house that anarchy built. And those of you familiar with the place can appreciate that designation. I also want to thank my mentors at University of Delaware and Washington State University for their inspiration and guidance. And WSU plays a fairly prominent role in today's story. And most of all, I want to thank the love of my life, Anne, for all of her support and wisdom, and for opening up our house to all of our students and colleagues. There's two other groups of people I want to acknowledge. And they're direct descendants of A.D. Hopkins in one way or another. And first of all are all of my students and graduate students and postdocs. Time won't allow me to describe their contributions individually or even show all their photographs. But really, it was their creativity and their energy that led to whatever discoveries we made. And I'm still learning from them. The second bunch is the collaborators I've had the opportunity and pleasure to work with over the years. Science really is an interdisciplinary undertaking, as all of you know, and each one of these folks has brought great ideas and equally novel toolboxes to assist in the various things we've had underway. And there's a tremendous diversity in terms of their backgrounds and interests and skill sets, but they all have one thing in common, and that is their direct descendants of A.D. Hopkins. So what I'd like to do today is talk first of all about the life and career of Hopkins, and then focus mostly on his major contributions, and then talk a little bit about how these contributions are relevant to today's challenges, and along there share with you a little bit of some unpublished data that we have trying to address those challenges as they unfold. Now, when you look at his biography, what strikes out first is just the longevity and the events he spanned. I mean, from 1857 to 1948, his life spanned the American Civil War all the way through the end of World War II, and his life overlapped with a number of you here in this audience. He was born on a farm in West Virginia, in what at the time was Virginia, and he had very little formal education. But like so many of us in this room, he was someone who just loved running around in the woods and exploring things and playing with nature. And he began his formal career not as an entomologist, but actually as a farmer. And he's somebody who, by today's terminology, would be referred to as an early adapter. He was always experimenting with new forms of plants, new varieties of livestock, and during this time, as an amateur, wrote a scholarly work on the raspberry borer without any formal training. He married Adelia Butcher. He had four children. One, Edwin, went on to become a petroleum geologist, probably a much more lucrative career than Hopkins had as an entomologist. And at the time of his death, he was survived only by Herbert and his immediate family. And then after his formal career, he returned to the farm and remained a very active researcher, much as you would see emeritus professors doing today. I want to acknowledge a couple of very good biographies on Hopkins and also some of the early forest entomologists in North America. One is by Wayne Beresford, another by Boyd Wickman, and another by Mal Furness that just recently appeared in American Entomologist. Now, like many of us in entomology, he kind of got his first break through a combination of good fortune and persistence and sort of just being at the right place at the right time. But he was able to coerce John Myers, who was then the director of the West Virginia Agricultural Experiment Station, into giving him a job. And so this is his actual letter of employment, laying out the job description, not too different from what you might get today, except it really underlined here. The underline says it's on a trial basis, so really went out of their way to say that. Kind of harsh, but not a whole lot different from the kind of letters new assistant professors get, kind of foreboding about this process called tenure. We do it a little bit more delicately now. His starting salary, I think, was $50 a month. I used some web-based applications to calculate. That would come out to about $1,300 a month now. But during this time, he received an honorary PhD and really became the prototype of what we think of as a modern land-grant entomologist, namely teaching, research, and outreach. He taught economic entomology, conducted research on a variety of things. One was not in forest entomology, it was in agricultural entomology, and he showed how delayed planting of wheat can reduce losses to Hessian fly, and permutations of that strategy are still used today. And he handled a variety of what we would now call extension duties. Well, from there he moved on to USDA and became the first head of the Bureau of Entomology and the Division of Forest Insect Investigations. And he worked with some of the most formative people of the period. He worked, for example, with C.V. Riley, who likewise has been honored as a founder, and at the same time collaborated with Gifford Pinchot, who was the founder of the U.S. Forest Service. Now, during this time, he went on a number of field excursions, and these were very formative in the ideas he eventually was to develop. He did field work in the Pacific Northwest, in New England, in South Dakota, in the Southeast, and was always keeping very, very detailed notes during all of these times. He also made some prominent hires during this time, and his first two hires were from my alma mater, Washington State University. One was Harry Burke, who was the first person to be awarded an entomology degree from WSU. He worked on buprestids. And the other was Jesse Webb, who worked on cerambycids. One of his most prominent hires during this period was Robert Snodgrass, who all of you know was the real founder of insect morphology and likewise has been honored as a founder. It was presented by Tom Eisner. Now, Hopkins was a very prolific writer, and I just wanted to highlight three major monographs that really illustrate the breadth of his contributions. The first was Report on Investigations to Determine the Cause of Unhealthy Conditions of the Spruce and Pine. The second was Bark Beetles of the Genus Dendrocnidus, and this was accompanied by two companion pieces that were taxonomic works on what was then the Scalidae. And the third was Bioclimatics. And I always think there's as much insight as looking into the subheadings of titles as there are into the main titles. The Dendrocnidus one was called Practical Information on the Scalidae Beetles of North American Forest. And the Bioclimatic one had a really interesting subtitle, at least I think so. It was called A Science of Life and Climate Relations, certainly a different side of Hopkins than the highly pragmatic side. I want to highlight that first report in particular, the Report on Investigations to Determine the Cause of Unhealthy Conditions of Spruce and Pine. Like a number of monographs of that period, it identified the major pests. It described their morphologies, life histories, host ranges, described the natural enemies and associates, and provided some control recommendations. But one of the things that's really striking about this is there are dozens of very meticulous drawings. And I've pulled out my favorite one here. It's a drawing he did of Dendrocnidus formicarius during his biological control explorations in Germany. And I've pasted right next to it a photograph we did in our lab of Thanasimus dubius. And I think it really highlights how from the very beginning he thought very carefully both of the morphology but also of the behavior and ecology of the insect. Now, what is really striking about this report, though, is that it did not begin with a description of the insects. Rather, it began with a description of the host plant ecology and the role of human disturbance in plant-insect interactions. And in a lot of ways, this really laid the foundation for how forest entomologists view their discipline. And I've pulled out a couple of quotations because I think they're very insightful. And rather than paraphrase Hopkins in these cases, I want him to speak to you directly. The first one, he said, thus, in worked-over regions, we find a labyrinth of log roads, log slides, and railroads, piles of spruce tops, old logs, broken trees, and brush, a perfect harbor and hotbed for myriads of wood and bark-infesting insects. So he was recognizing, even then, that what we think of as forest pest problems were largely an outgrowth of human management activities. And then he said, clear-cutting, grazing, and other activities probably had the effect of materially reducing the humidity of the atmosphere and soil and exposing mountain ranges to drying winds, forest fires, and fierce storms. And so in 1899, recognizing that human activities had impacts on weather, and those effects on weather had feedback to forest insect populations. And then he said, with a little care and systematic management, much of the land worthless for anything else, meaning agriculture, could be made to produce a dense growth of spruce. And so highlighting the role of forest entomologists as applied ecologists, but then proceeding to a somewhat pessimistic note and saying, but the demand on the forest is correspondingly great and under present conditions must be supplied regardless of future consequences to the land and to the state, really laying out the tension that has been through all forest entomology and natural resource management to this date. Now, in this same monograph, he really laid out some very seminal ideas on population regulation, disturbance interactions, and the role of climate in insect population dynamics. And again, I want him to speak to you directly because it is quite profound that in 1899, he said, it is apparently the rule that when almost any species increases to excessive abundance, it is sooner or later reduced to its normal position by parasitic and predaceous insects, unfavorable climate conditions, or all combined, recognizing that most systems were multi-causal rather than single causal events. And when he talked about disturbance interactions, I love the language that was used back then, somewhat playful. He had a section he called Insect Friends of Scalitids and talked about caterpillars and how defoliation by caterpillars enhanced susceptibility. You know, this is still an active area of research, only now we would call it inter-guild host-mediated interactions. And he was obviously feeling, wanted to take a little swipe at the powers that be. He had a section in there that he called Man as a Friend of the Scalitids. So he lumped us right in there with the caterpillars and said, man, especially civilized man, is among the best friend of Scalitids in causing the favorable conditions for their multiplication. And he also recognized the complexity of things, a very contentious area of policy right now is addressing interactions between insects and forest fires. And he said forest fires offer both favorable and unfavorable conditions for Scalitids. And he proceeded into discussion of the role of climate and even then recognized that there were both direct effects on the insects and indirect effects mediated through the host plant. And this is one of my favorite quotes. He was talking about the collapse of a southern pine beetle outbreak that was brought about by a sudden cold snap. And he said, it was as if a supreme power, dissatisfied with the undue increases of the species and the widespread devastations wrought by it, had sent a plague to exterminate it. I think we would all love it, those of us who do field work, the next time our variance is so high that we can invoke a supreme power as the underlying explanation. But then behind that kind of language was always the rigor. He then proceeded to speculate that there were geographic races that vary in cold hardiness, and we now know this to be true for many species of insects. I just wanted to highlight a couple of other things from that paper. This shows the phenology chart he drew of the southern pine beetle, and I think all of you will recognize that as very similar to the same kinds of phenology charts we draw today and still appear in our journals. He also had a diagram that caught my fancy on his depiction of induced defenses. And induced defenses against bark beetles is something that really was not recognized until Canadian researchers during the early 1970s began exploring it in detail. And on the left, you can see Hopkins' drawing of an autonecrotic lesion where pine trees had defended itself against southern pine beetle. And next to it, you can see a photograph I took of the same phenomena in the late 80s. He also included his expense report right in the monograph. I don't want to give any administrators any ideas. this uh, is something that, who knows, it might be the next thing you're all going to have to do after your trips. In the process, Hopkins also laid the foundation for what we think of as modern forest entomology. He did this through his early hires, in addition to the ones I mentioned, were Craighead, and also John Miller and Paul Keene, shown here in this photograph, and they wrote some of the major manuals on forest entomology. But the people he hired almost all had as their emphases plant-insect interactions, life history, and responses to climate. And it's interesting to me because if you look at the various Comstock Awards that have gone to graduate students in this society whose area has been forest entomology, almost all of them have been in those very areas that Hopkins laid out. And in terms of his personality, his obituary, and also some of his colleagues described him as an expert pool player, energetic, generous, and a bit argumentative. That sounds like about half the forest entomologists I know. Some of that argumentativeness can be seen in his writing, that 1899 paper I mentioned. He has an erratum section in there, and he really goes out of his way to point out that he was not given a chance to go through the galley proofs, that this had been published while he was out in the Northwest. And that paper on Dendrocnidus, he gives some very specific control recommendations in there. But then right in the monograph says, but none of this is going to happen. There's not enough money. I really can't picture a USDA manual today being quite that blunt in saying this is what society needs to do, but no, they're not going to do it. And some of his correspondence with individuals who were both political figures and simultaneously employees of the timber industry were quite pointed, and in a few cases he did go out of his way that he knew what he knew what he was talking about, and they didn't. Now, as we look at the culture of forest entomology, I think the biggest advance since those days is, like so many areas of science, it was almost exclusively a male domain. And that is finally changing. At the most recent Western Forest Insect Work Conference, just last spring, speakers pointed out that as recently as 1988, only 11% of the participants were women. And in the most recent one, that number is now 38% and very much rising. And this has really enriched our field and at the same time maintained all four of those traits that Hopkins brought to the table. Now, one of the ironies of Hopkins' career is that the theory for which he's most well known is a theory that is widely disparaged. And it's known as Hopkins' host selection principle. At the core, it says adult insects show preference for species on which they developed. But this became highly controversial. And by the time I was a graduate student in the 1970s, it was largely dismissed. An example of the kind of articles written about it is Van Emden's in 1996. Hopkins' host selection principle, another nail in its coffin. Ouch. Really, at the heart of the controversy was the assumption that this fidelity to host plant was related to learning that took place during the larval stage. And there's a very good review of this written by Andrew Barron, and he really summarizes it when he said that the assumption that Hopkins' host selection principle implies behavior of adult insects is conditioned by larval experience has resulted in widespread condemnation. Ironically, this part of the theory is not something that was advanced by Hopkins himself. It actually was advanced by some of the early adherents to it that presumed the mechanism must be larval learning, and then after that brought about the backlash. And to some extent, I think it was a case of bad timing. I think it struck people as largely Lamarckian. But if you look at just the core of it, the idea that host learning takes place is not something that we would find particularly controversial now, thinking about parasitic insects, for example, although not necessarily by the larvae. The actual formulation of Hopkins' host selection principle was not in a written publication, but rather it came about in a question and answering period at the American Association of Economic Entomologists. And Hopkins got up and said, mountain pine beetle within a region tends to persist on one pine species and will take many years to change from one host species to another, including within that the possibility of host races, learning, and a variety of other mechanisms. Now, one theory that I think very few people are aware of or would attribute to Hopkins is perhaps his most far-reaching one. It's called the Hopkins percentage principle in 1909, and it really laid the foundation for what we now think of as integrated pest management, threshold and nonlinearity theory, and allele effects. And again, I want Hopkins to speak to you directly. He said, it is not only useless, but unnecessary to attempt complete eradication. It is necessary, however, to so reduce and weaken their forces that they cannot continue an aggressive attack, thus leaving them to depend upon weakened and felled trees for their support and to occupy a defensive position against their natural enemies. And he went on to say, the beetles must occur in great numbers in order to be successful in their attack on healthy trees. If their number is reduced and kept below that required for killing trees, they can do no harm. Therefore, it is necessary to destroy only 50 to 75% of them to bring them under complete control. This is something now I think most of us involved in IPM would not find controversial, but yet it was something that was largely ignored until the early 1970s. During the 1970s, when I was a graduate student, I tested a portion of this theory directly. I didn't realize at the time this was originally A.D. Hopkins, but that's me caging a bunch of lodgepole pines, and depending on how many beetles came in, if I closed the cage too soon before a lot came in, the tree killed all the beetles. And if I allowed all the beetles to come in, the beetles killed the tree, and there was no signature whatsoever of the tree ever having had any resistance capability, which is exactly what Hopkins would have predicted. The third major contribution is referred to as Hopkins' bioclimatic law. And it really is amazing because in 1919, he related latitude, elevation, and longitude and developed a mathematical formulation for doing so. 1 degree of latitude equals 400 feet of elevation equals 4 degrees of longitude. And he referred to these as isophanes. This is so widely used now in horticulture, agronomy, population modeling, landscape ecology, that I think most of those practitioners would not even be aware of who its original author was and that that person happened to be an entomologist. This diagram on the right is what North America, specifically the United States, looked like to A.D. Hopkins. It's difficult to read, but on the left axis is elevation. On the x-axis, it begins on the left with the Pacific Ocean and extends all the way to the Atlantic Ocean. And the lines refer to various isophanes at which he was reporting snow level, tree line, and a variety of phenological indicators. He invested very heavily in this and had large numbers of his employees while he was at USDA conducting phenological observations. And I think at the same time, this also added somewhat to the allure of forest entomology. These folks who were way out there in the bush engaged simultaneously in an intellectual pursuit, but also testing their wilderness skills. Well, he published his compendium on this in 1938, and he laid out five major principles. And I'll just let you read those, but they really are quite profound. Now, if you look at this document, one of the things that strikes you is the style of writing has changed quite a bit. It's a good deal less playful, it's very data dense, and it's quite directive. But he's an older man at this point. He was 81 when he wrote this, and so he had changed, but also the field of science had changed as well. But I find it quite inspirational that at the age of 81, he was cutting edge, laying out principles of bioclimatics for which there really were no parallel at the time. And I think these five principles, to a large extent now, would be widely accepted. Well, if we fast forward to today's times, I think we could see that many of our current and emerging natural resource issues stand to benefit a lot from the teachings and research of Hopkins. And I want to give as an example the recent bark beetle outbreaks in western conifer systems. These are natural disturbance events. Bark beetles play important roles in forest ecology, but in recent years we've been seeing these outbreaks on an unprecedented scale, larger than in the past, more frequent than in the past, occupying geographic ranges and elevations where they had not been predominant in the past, and at a higher synchronicity among the various species in the past. Over about a 12-year period, there have been many dozens of millions of hectares impacted by these bark beetle outbreaks. And a very nice paper by Kurtz and colleagues showed that mountain pine beetle is actually converting lodgepole pine, the predominant vegetation in British Columbia, from a carbon sink to a carbon source, actually having feedback in weather patterns. If we explore these current outbreaks in detail, we really see a confluence of the three major themes that were identified by Hopkins: weather, thresholds at multiple scale, and host selection behavior. Now, this is from a recent paper, and it was through a collaborative effort. My colleagues were Brian Alkema, Barbara Benz, Alan Carroll, Jeff Hickey, Monica Turner, and Bill Ramey. And it was Alan Carroll who took the lead on this particular analysis, and I think it's really insightful. He was exploring the three major outbreaks that we were seeing: mountain pine beetle, spruce beetle, and pinyonips, and asked for each of these, was it possible to identify a weather anomaly associated with the outbreak? And in all three cases, the answer was yes. But then as you explore further, those correlations often break down with the continuation of the outbreak, indicating that a threshold had been breached. In the case of mountain pine beetle, even though the predisposing factor was drought, once the drought had subsided, the outbreak persisted. In the case of spruce beetle, the predisposing factor was high temperature, but some of the worst years of infestation were actually after temperature had returned to normal. The case of pinyonips was very different. In this case, the population tracked reduced precipitation all the way through the onset, the duration, and the decline. And I think there's two important messages here. One is that even though our policymakers love to have a one-size-fits-all approach, not all outbreaks are equal. They have different dynamics. And secondly, as many of you know, the more current models of climate change predict not only changes in the mean, but changes in the variance. And what some of these cases illustrate is once you pass a critical threshold, you now get self-perpetuating dynamics in a way that is regime change. Now that describes pattern. If we start exploring process, this is a paper that Celia Boone and some colleagues are working on. And just like Hopkins had illustrated the importance of inducible defenses, when we ask the question, what's the difference between trees that mountain pine beetle attacks and mountain pine beetle does not attack, the most significant predictor was the capability of these trees to undergo inducible reactions in terms of total monoterpene accumulation in response to a simulated attack. But that's when the population was in its endemic low-density phase. Once it was in its transitory phase, populations had increased, that relationship was totally lost, and once it was in its outbreak phase, it actually went in the opposite direction, again pointing out the type of threshold behavior that Hopkins had found at multiple levels of scale. Now, if you go beyond looking at it in terms of pattern and tree physiological process and look at it in terms of host selection, it's even more revealing. This is part of the same paper. Brian Alkema took the lead in this part. And what I've shown on the y-axis is the percentage of trees in the stand that had a trait. In this case, it was resin flow, but it was the same for all of them. Below that, that was attacked by mountain pine beetle. And you could see when the population was in its endemic phase, these things really were just relying on the most stressed individuals of the population. But then once it was in its transition phase, it was actually getting trees that were more in the median part of the population. And again, the average of the population had now increased because the beetle had already skimmed off the bottom. And once it was in the eruptive phase, it actually was preferentially selecting the most well-defended trees. Now, it kind of raises the question, why would a beetle preferentially attack the most well-defended trees? And it calls to mind the quote when a reporter once asked John Dillinger, why do you rob banks? And he said, because that's where the money is. Well, this is where the phloem is. Those trees that have the thickest phloem and are the most vigorous are the ones that are the most dangerous to attack, but if you can do it, those are the ones that also provide the most brood production and you get positive feedback. Now, in terms of the mechanism by which this happens, we really don't know, but some previous work by Kimberly Wallen on spruce beetles showed that it is a gene by environment interaction involving different population sources of the beetle and signaling that involves signals both from the plant and from the insect, again, hearkening back on Hopkins' words about things being multi-causal. Now, in addition to more outbreaks, we're now seeing ecosystems being impacted by mountain pine beetle that have not historically been impacted, at least on a continual basis. We're seeing outbreaks at higher elevations than before and at higher latitudes than before, exactly as Hopkins would have predicted based on his bioclimatic law and what he told us about multivoltinism of mountain pine beetle. In the case of these high elevation systems, unlike the Historicos lodgepole pine, which is very disturbance adapted, these are very fragile ecosystems, mostly white bark pine, a very slow growing species, and keystone species. Because of mountain pine beetle responding to climatic change, just last year the grizzly bear was relisted as an endangered species because it relies on the cones of those trees for its overwintering nutrients. In addition, mountain pine beetle has now breached the historic barrier of the Rocky Mountains. This was a classic paper by Jesse Logan and Jim Powell, an American entomologist, in 2001. And they predicted that at the current rate of warming, within 6 years, mountain pine beetle would now be in the area of Alberta where lodgepole pine and jack pine naturally hybridize. And they predicted it almost to the day. It is, in fact, reproducing in that area. And none of us really know now what are going to be the environmental consequences of mountain pine beetle being linked with the boreal forest and the eastern forest. Now, luckily, some of the most outstanding members of the forest entomology community are working on exactly that problem today. And it would be a gross oversimplification of their work, but basically what we do know is that there's higher survival of winter extreme and more rapid development, a switch in many cases from a semi-voltine life cycle to a univoltine life cycle. Well, the question we've been asking is how do the defenses of the historic host, namely lodgepole pine, compare with the defenses of the relatively naive host, namely whitebark pine? The short answer is we don't know. We've done a number of bioassays. We've done behavioral bioassays, giving the beetles a chance to go into bark discs of either whitebark pine or lodgepole pine. We did not see any differences there. We also did some studies asking perhaps the toxicity of the resin of one species was higher than the other. We didn't see any difference there. But one thing that really struck out is that the relatively naive host, whitebark pine, has very minimal induced defenses. And I show that based on two projects. The one is with Celia Boone, Barbara Bentz, and Andy Lurch. And in this case, the induced defenses took place in terms of natural attack. And if you look at the constitutive monoterpenes, the yellow, there's really no difference between the lodgepole and the whitebark pine. But if you look at the inducible defenses, they're very pronounced in the lodgepole pine, and the whitebark pine basically just sits there, does not seem to know what's going on. And in the lower panel, here we did the induction with controlled inoculation to complement it, but we saw the same pattern. Very little difference in the constitutive. In this case, there was a little bit, but as you can see, no inducible responses whatsoever. And so this does not bode well for this particular ecosystem. And in addition to that, there are some chemical differences that suggest that it might be easier for mountain pine beetle to elicit those mass attacks and get past that threshold that A.D. Hopkins talked about in his percentage principle. That might be easier when beetles are boring into the naive host, whitebark pine, than the historic host. I say that because there is a trace component in the resin, 4AA, and some work by Jane Hayes and Brian Strom had shown it's an inhibitor of the bark beetle pheromone. And in both studies we did, that material is much lower in the whitebark pine than the historic lodgepole pine. Again, this is something we're going to have to test explicitly to find out if it's true, but it shows how we're now into an area of great unknowns. The last thought I want to leave you with is that these examples I've shown with mountain pine beetle and the others are not unique. We're seeing many cases like this with changing climate and other anthropogenic increases. In the southwestern United States, there are geometrids that had previously been undescribed, now undergoing causing winter defoliation. In the overwintering areas of the monarch butterfly, drought has favored outbreaks of bark beetles that are affecting the fir canopy of where they overwinter. Closer to home, in Wisconsin, we have a monophagous insect, a strict monophage, jack pine budworm, that is now feeding extensively on red pine. And that transition is being caused not by climate change, but rather by a complete conversion of the habitat. And so I think if we stand back and look at the major challenges that were facing the founders of forest entomology, they were dealing with things that were largely from internal forces, things driving local population dynamics and management regime. But if we look at the emerging issues, they're largely external forces, things such as climate change, invasive species, habitat conversion, and equally important, the interfaces of competing land uses and socioeconomic values. And I think regardless of the area of entomology you're in, I think you would find this to be true. For those of you who are medical entomologists, you've documented very good examples where climate change is causing both latitudinal expansions of arthropod vectors of human pathogens and elevational changes. Invasive species, many cases of arthropod vectors of human pathogens being introduced, and some very nice examples of how deforestation is favoring Anopheles mosquitoes. For those of you involved in agricultural entomology, I think you would come up with a list very, very similar to this. In addition, there'd be macroeconomic forces associated with global change. And so given that the biggest challenge facing us now is these emerging issues with largely external drivers, I think we can use that to frame the challenge. And I'm going to leave you with two thoughts about how to address it. One is a largely scientific challenge. And again, just as Hal Hopkins talked about these cross-scale interactions, I think more than anything else, we need to improve our ability to link pattern and process and link interactions across scales. I'm confident we're going to be able to meet that challenge. Today's graduate students are brighter than ever before. Our technologies are brighter than ever before. The climate for interdisciplinary collaboration is better than ever before. That's why we're all here in San Diego. But the second one is largely a policy one, and that is we really cannot continue managing systems that are driven on a scale of decades and centuries over large landscapes under the current political cycles and small jurisdictional cycles under which we're currently doing it. And I realize that recommendation goes very much against the current political tides. And so this really calls our role of educators into play. Educators both at the university level and at the K-12 level. One of the best things about the journal American Entomologist is for the last 5 years, it seems, every single article has had at least, issue has had at least one really good article on K-12 and related education. And hopefully, our political leaders will be responding in a logical way to a scientifically literate population. And if that doesn't work out like A.D. Hopkins, we can invoke divine intervention against the plague. And with that, I thank you for your attention.